Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Liberalism in Dark Times, The Liberal Ethos in the 20th Century, by Joshua L. Chernus, narrated by Stephen J. Cohen. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to visual elements present in the print and e-book formats of the book. But the liberal deviseth liberal things, and by liberal things shall he stand. Isaiah, chapter 32, verse 8, King James Version. Don't imitate them. Don't imitate them. Surpass them in your moral conduct. Surpass them by your generosity. I do not ask, however, that you should lose strength in the struggle or zeal in the fight. I ask for hard, steely breasts for combat, but with sensitive hearts, capable of shuddering at human pain, able to shelter mercy and tender feelings, without which that which is most essential to human greatness is lost. Indalecio Prieto, radio address of August 8, 1936. Introduction. The Vices of Virtue: Liberalism and the Problem of Ruthlessness. Virtue itself has need of limits. In that how lies all the difference. How do humanitarian idealists become butchers of human beings? How do they convince themselves that they are virtuous in their butchery? This is a question that should trouble those of us who cherish hopes of bettering the world through politics. It is the question of Robespierre, the champion of the rights of man and opponent of the death penalty who presided over the reign of terror. The question of Gheorghe Lucat, the sensitive idealist turned commissar, panegyrist of Lenin, and abettor of Stalin. It is a question raised by countless others who have traveled from humanism to inhumanity, who have embraced murderous causes because they came to believe it morally imperative and politically urgent to do so. It is easy, at least for some of us, to condemn the French revolutionary terrorists, Stalinist secret police, or Maoist Red Guards, but a careful study of the personal roots of these horrors should be an antidote to complacency, as perhaps should a moment of self-examination. Few of these political murderers started out as monsters, and readiness to sacrifice individuals in the pursuit of moral causes often takes less dramatic and bloody forms, which many of us could find in ourselves if we looked. Anyone who feels the force of revulsion against the injustice, cruelty, and oppression of this world should be alert to this temptation. So should those who believe that they have discovered the truth about how to improve human life, whether this truth is secular or religious and identified with the political right or left. Ruthlessness, understood as both a feature of action and a quality of thought and feeling that rejects all scruples, doubts, hesitation, and remorse in pursuing some ultimate purpose or serving some paramount principle, possesses an attractive simplicity and strength. It grants a sense of direction and meaning, garrisoning the mind against the terror of uncertainty. It lends a feeling of strength, a patina of psychological power, a glamour of toughness. Hence, politicians seem never to tire of declaring metaphorical wars, or, for example, announcing the goal of achieving total domination through the use of force by very tough, strong, powerful people. Ruthlessness possesses a self-enforcing psychology. Once one has set one's heart on ruthlessness, it can be hard to escape. And the pragmatic arguments for ruthlessness are potent. Within politics, a realm of passionate, often unprincipled struggle, how can one be effective in urgently pursuing a just cause, especially when faced with the ruthlessness of others, without hardening one's heart, stopping one's ears, getting one's hands dirty. Many political evils, of course, stem from garden variety villainy, ambition, venality, the appetite for domination or longing for submission. But righteous ruthlessness is particularly troubling insofar as it can transform apparent virtues into terrible vices. As a disillusioned communist in Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate reflects, the terrible paradox of communism was that it freed people from morality in the name of morality. For the sake of a fine and noble cause, it justified killing, crippling, uprooting and terrorizing and licensed Pharisees, hypocrites, and writers of denunciation. This showed how the very concept of good can become a scourge, a greater evil than evil itself. The combination of idealism and cynicism in the pursuit of noble goals through brutal means is particularly potent in its appeal and horrific in its consequences. Liberalism and the Politics of Limits. The tendency to pass from humanitarian idealism to ruthlessness can occur among adherents of diverse political visions and programs. No ideology or party is immune. Governments and movements have called for the brutal infliction of death, imprisonment, and material misery in the name of freedom or justice, capitalism or socialism, growth or greatness, and numerous other inspiring slogans. Yet there is a strong affinity between this tendency and anti-liberal politics, politics that forcefully rejects liberal principles and seeks to demolish liberal institutions. And while individuals from across the political spectrum have diagnosed and proposed prophylactics against political ruthlessness, there is a strong affinity between liberalism and a propensity to feel horror at political ruthlessness and to regard combating it as a vital political task. Those who have been repulsed by political ruthlessness have often been driven toward liberalism, whatever their ideological starting point. Indeed, liberalism itself emerged out of reaction against the ruthlessness of the French Revolutionary Terror and fear of answering reactionary ruthlessness. Not all forms of liberalism are equally concerned with ruthlessness or able to resist impulses toward ruthlessness on behalf of liberal objectives. While recent liberal theory may not license ruthlessness, it also has little to say about it, having focused largely on questions of justification and institutional principles. Yet not long ago, the practical challenge of ruthlessness inspired a distinctive strand of liberal thinking. I reconstruct, retrieve, and develop that liberalism here. Liberalism covers broad, well-trodden, and contested terrain. Any definition is liable to be controversial. It variously denotes support for a mildly redistributionist welfare state combined with significant personal liberty and commitment to the free market, or a political theory defined by the framework of the social contract, or methodological individualism, or affirmation of the priority of the right over the good. I do not use liberalism in any of these ways here. Likewise, by anti-liberalism, I do not mean libertarian, communitarian, civic republican, conservative socialist, or perfectionist critics of the foregoing positions, but rather those who reject liberal principles and practices and seek to overturn them root and branch. Liberal politics is limited politics, institutionally, normatively, ethically. Institutionally, liberals embrace limits such as the rule of law enforced through an independent judiciary, charters of guaranteed individual rights, the selection and removal of political officials by popular vote, an internally diverse civil society endowed with protections against the dictates of the state, and with the power to criticize or resist the state. Beyond this, liberalism inoculates norms of recognizing such limits as legitimate and desirable. It may also encourage internalizing acceptance of limits in undertaking political action, even in the silence of the law. This insistence on limits reflects a commitment to promoting individual liberty, understood as the ability of every adult to make as many effective decisions without fear or favor about as many aspects of her or his life as is compatible with the like freedom of every other adult, and promoting a society marked by the diversity and disagreement that the practice of liberty produces. Liberalism seeks to reduce as much as possible the fear, the frustrating sense of immobility or entrapment, the cramping of character and narrowing of horizons through deprivation or coercion, and the arbitrariness and arrogance of authority within a society. Liberalism's negativity, its tendencies to define itself in terms of what it opposes and seeks to protect against, should not be overstated, as it often is. Liberalism reflects not only fears but ideals, aspirations to rich individual self-development, and a society marked by greater justice and mutual respect. It does not merely accept diversity and even discord, but rejoices in it, because it is in diversity alone that freedom can be realized, for a free society is not one in which people are merely allowed to make effective social choices among a variety of alternatives, but one in which they are encouraged to do so. Liberal politics is not only a limited, but as the word's origins suggest, a generous or magnanimous politics. But this generosity typically takes the form of forbearance and tolerance, which is one reason why it is not always recognized. Another is liberals' own failure to live up to their ideals. Liberals do not, like conservatives, stand athwart history shouting stop. At their best, they stand between vulnerable individuals and the predations of power and insist on limits so far but no further, as Camus had said. There is more to liberalism than this, but this is liberalism's spine. Political ruthlessness is naturally opposed to liberalism thus understood. It is defined by an insistence that certain goals or principles override individual rights or liberties and justify the use of unbridled power, the infliction of untold suffering, the obliteration or blighting of countless individual lives. Such ruthlessness poses a serious problem. How can liberals respond effectively to it without emulating it? It also challenges the seriousness and sincerity of liberalism. Is it the liberal who refrains from pursuing her goals when doing so seems to require ruthless action really that committed to those goals in the first place? This liberal vulnerability is evoked whenever people quote, whether wryly, regretfully, or maliciously, Robert Frost's definition of a liberal as one too broad-minded to take his own side in a quarrel. Here, Frost identifies liberalism with a feature of character, outlook, and approach, and a consequent deficiency in action. This deficiency may seem fairly harmless as political vices go, even endearing. But what happens when liberals find themselves in a quarrel with those who oppose liberalism root and branch, and particularly those who oppose it in a way that threatens the basic values and interests that liberals hold dear? What happens, in other words, when liberals come up against political ruthlessness? This question is at the heart of what I call, adopting a phrase from Isaiah Berlin, the liberal predicament. The main crux of this predicament can be articulated as how to combat anti-liberal movements which are not constrained in the way that liberal movements and regimes are, without either sacrificing political efficacy or betraying basic liberal principles in the name of defending them. Faced with ruthless anti-liberal attacks, to remain a good liberal in the sense of adhering to liberal principles threatens to make one a failed liberal. Yet, to become ruthless in the fight against ruthlessness threatens to leave one no longer a liberal at all. It is telling that Frost and Berlin characterized liberalism as they did at roughly the same time. In the 20th century, political ruthlessness achieved particular salience as a defining challenge for liberalism. As I show in the next chapter, the embrace of ruthlessness was generated and justified by a reaction against liberalism's perceived failings. Liberalism, in turn, was refined by its encounter with political ruthlessness. This reflects an important but often neglected feature of 20th century politics: the conflict between liberals and their fiercest opponents in the early to mid-20th century was fundamentally ethical in two distinct senses. First, the terms of this conflict centered to a significant extent on questions of political ethics as distinct from moral philosophy. Political ethics, as I understand the term, assumes that politics involves its own characteristic means, challenges, burdens, and opportunities. Thinking about political ethics means beginning from these political phenomena, rather than beginning with a more universal theory of morality and seeking to draw out applications to politics from this pre-political moral theory. At the same time, recognizing the porousness, complexity, and inextricability of politics and other facets of life, political ethics approaches questions about how to act politically within a larger context of thinking about how a life should be lived and what sort of character we should try to cultivate or what qualities we want to characterize our conduct toward and relationships with others. As distinct from more architectonic forms of political theory, political ethics is concerned not with general moral duties or purposes or the institutional architecture of politics, but with the conduct, character, and cultivated convictions of individual actors as these arise in their pursuit of political projects. If political theory on the whole identifies what sort of political order we should seek, political ethics asks what we should and should not do and become in pursuing that order. Many accounts of 20th century political thought focus on questions of ends, institutions, and policy, the relationship between politics and economics, and the proper goals of economic policy, the basis, functions, and boundaries of the state and political membership, the meaning of concepts such as liberty, equality, justice, authority, or legitimacy. These issues were obviously crucial, but the clash between liberals and anti-liberals also centered on political ethical questions. How the demands of politics relate to the dictates of personal morality, the relationship between means and ends, the significance of personal character in defining political action. Faced with grotesque horrors, massacre, torture, cynical manipulation, blatant lies, pervasive terror, those I term tempted liberals reaffirmed the moral value of scruples, of inner doubts and hesitations as to the propriety of this or that practice. They also grappled with the ethical challenges that commitment to scruple imposed. The conflict between liberals and anti-liberals was ethical. Second, insofar as both sides were defined by a political ethos, a stance or bearing formed by patterns of disposition, perception, commitment, and response, which shapes how individuals or groups go about acting politically. The liberals I discuss here, in particular, came to be preoccupied with what the American literary critic Lionel Trilling termed the morality of morality. Reflection not on what course of action should be chosen, but on the quality of the moral life lived in pursuit of that course. This quality of moral life, Trilling added, is shaped by the sensibility and manner through which political views are related to the character of our personal being. These liberals articulated, defended, and exemplified a liberalism shaped by a combination of sensibility, manner, and personal being, with reflection on the morality of morality. Retrieving this ethically centered liberalism has two implications for how we think about political theory and liberal theory in particular. First, it nudges us away from the focus on institutions and the tendency to think in terms of general principles, which have shaped much recent liberal theory and toward greater attention to individual character, temperament, and sensibility. In this regard, my account converges with the recent turn of a diverse range of political theorists to the idea of ethos, a term I have adopted and which I clarify in the next chapter. This turn reflects a sense that there is something else besides the formal features of government, that is, institutions, laws, and procedures, the general principles of political morality, or the proper ends of politics, to which political theory should pay more attention. Yet the nature of this something else often remains obscure. An ethos may be conceived, as William Connolly suggests, as the sensibility or manner through which a creed or belief system is applied. I will suggest a more complicated picture. An ethos, as I use the term, encompasses both such a sensibility or temper and the larger framework of perception and thought through which it is brought to bear on determining how to hold and act on the creed. To embrace one or another creed will influence one toward and away from one or another ethos or several ethe. At the same time, one's ethos will dispose one toward particular creeds. To take ethos seriously is not to neglect the power or importance of theories, doctrines, or arguments. It is rather to recognize the important role ethos plays in how these come to be applied or lived in political practice. A major claim of this book is that there is something not only paradoxical but potentially self-defeating and even pathological about seeking to live a liberal creed through an illiberal ethos. Through my analysis of political ruthlessness and of a line of liberal response to it, I develop an account of ethos that allows us to better grasp what distinguishes liberal and anti-liberal politics, and that may aid us in evaluating different ways of applying and defending liberal ideals. In doing so, I suggest a larger claim that attending to ethos is vital to understanding what moves and guides individuals, appreciating the quality of their actions, and comprehending what attracts them to and divides them into different political camps. In order to understand what was and is at stake in the conflict between liberalism and its fiercest enemies, we must, as Amanda Anderson has argued, move beyond blunt ideological labels defined in terms of doctrines and programs, and attend to contrasting styles and dispositions. Politics should be approached not solely through the question of who does what to whom for whose benefit, but also through the additional question of how do they, the actors, do it, the action to them. And this how should be approached in terms not only of processes of action, but also of the attitude sustained and the temper and dispositions displayed in actions, qualities that determine the full significance of the action itself. As Andrew Sabol has noted, in politics, decency and much else, both good and bad, lives in the adverbs. How one intends to exercise power, within what constraints, with what underlying attitudes. The description and analysis of political action should be conducted in a more adjectival and adverbial style than we are often accustomed to practice it. In addition to suggesting how political, especially liberal theory, may benefit from attending to ethos, my historical account retrieves another liberalism, different from those most often encountered in histories of liberalism or discussions of contemporary liberal theory. This liberalism was conceived by those who articulated it as an ethical disposition, irreducible to logically entailed principles or programs. I call this tempered liberalism. It is a liberalism tempered, that is, at once chastened and ultimately reaffirmed and strengthened by the crucible of criticism, struggle, and tribulation, a liberalism that is informed by and seeks to maintain a poise of balance between and maintain its balance against extremes, and a liberalism that centers on personal temperament, seeking not to advance a general theory or program of institutional design or a set of general principles, but to cultivate a particular way of thinking about and engaging in political life. Tempered also indicates opposition to ruthlessness, insofar as to be tempered is to be restrained, balanced, circumspect. The ethos of tempered liberalism was not only the antithesis of ruthlessness, but rejection of ruthlessness, extremism, and fanaticism was among its central features. Concerns with both political ruthlessness and liberalism's ability to respond to it, to both counter it effectively and avoid incubating it within liberalism itself, are all too relevant. And I will return to the contemporary resonance of tempered liberalism in the conclusion, but my concerns here are not only contemporary or normative. This is a work of history which enriches existing accounts of liberalism's past and challenges perceptions of Cold War liberalism. There has been among many political theorists and historians what Jan Werner Muller calls a systematic forgetting of what Cold War liberals actually said and meant. Narratives of post-war liberalism typically identify one or some combination of several tendencies. One is a change of mood from a more ambitious and hopeful to a conservative, gloomy, anxious liberalism, which discouraged political experimentation and effervescence. Closely connected to this is a shift in political program from the more progressive liberalism embodied in the New Deal, especially in its early years, to a combination of managerial rule, cultural consensus, and defense of the status quo. Another story depicts liberalism becoming abstract, individualistic, and privatized. This shift was both substantive, emphasizing personal rights, private interests, and fair procedures rather than civic duties, virtuous character formation, and the common good, and methodological, relying on abstract theorizing rather than thick political and social analysis. Post-war liberalism on this account was demoralizing in the double sense of sapping enthusiasm by failing to offer an inspiring ethical ideal and undercutting concern with civic virtue, and depoliticizing, encouraging a retreat from civic responsibilities. Finally, critics attribute to post-war liberalism a growing rigidity, as it defined itself against a communist other, dug in its heels, and closed its mind. These shifts are seen as fostering quietism, defeatism, disillusionment, a celebration of apathy, and the sickness of complacency, thereby stifling political imagination and experimentation and obstructing progress. These stories, accurate concerning some post-war liberalisms, do not capture the full story. They are misleading when applied to tempered liberals, who remained morally robust and politically engaged, and indeed stressed the need to cultivate an ethically strenuous set of dispositions if liberal politics were to be sustained. Nor did tempered liberalism represent a turn to a cramping liberal fundamentalism. This, indeed, is one reason for its neglect. Always too complex, unsystematic, and personal to serve as the basis for a movement or ideology, tempered liberalism was eclipsed both by alternative responses to totalitarianism, which offered more robust defenses of the superiority of constitutionalist and capitalist institutions, and the more systematic high liberalism of Rawls and others. Subsequent communitarian and realist critiques of Rawlsian individualist or libertarian variants of liberalism, for all their theoretical and practical importance, have tended to lack tempered liberalism's sense of the existential fragility of liberalism as a political achievement and the ethical demandingness of liberalism as a political disposition. Recent expositions of liberalism have also neglected tempered liberals' practice of exemplarity, their efforts to engage in a non-coercive and non-perfectionist political ethical pedagogy through the evocation of a liberal ethos, both in their accounts of others and their own conduct and authorial personae. For Lionel Trilling, the great vice of academism is that it is concerned with ideas rather than with thinking.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?